And our Stop the Violence, Start the Healing campaign continues. This is our 19th Stop the Violence, Start the Healing campaign on KHUM, as incredible as that may seem. This week we are dealing with the culture of aggression, and there has been a lot in the news about various different things where the culture of aggression has shown itself. And because of this, it has become obvious that there are lots of places where there is a culture of aggression where it's not only not discouraged, but sometimes encouraged as well. So joining me today here in the studio, we've got Professor Maxwell Schnurr from Humboldt State University.
Hi, Cliff.
How are you doing?
Great, thanks.
And you are the department chair for communication.
Absolutely,
well.
Yeah.
Fantastic. Well, thanks for coming in. I really, really appreciate that.
Yeah.
And the reason that you are here is you are really a busy person dealing with a lot of this stuff right on the front lines. As a matter of fact, explain the program
Sure.
that you guys are doing.
I'm the co-chair of the Sexual Assault Prevention Committee, which is the clearinghouse around Humboldt State for all of the work that goes on to fight rape, sexualized violence, harassment, and stalking, intimate partner violence. And so we coordinate many programs and also sort of act as a space where all of the various folks from police officers to housing get the chance to coordinate with each other to be effective in our programming.
And how exactly do you do that?
Well, we meet monthly, and we run very efficient meetings with most of the key decision makers. And out of that group comes an enormous number of products. Most notably, and one of the things that I'm the most proud about is about 2.5 years ago, we received a $250,000 grant from the Department of Justice Office of Violence Against Women for a campus grant intended to help HSU be better at preventing sexualized violence. And we used that money to hire a couple of phenomenal folks who do very strong prevention education, as well as a couple other great projects.
Who are some of those folks?
Sure. Mary Sue Savage is our prevention coordinator who helps to run our Check It program, which is the campus bystander intervention program. And that has been an incredible success in buy-in with students, and also has had the sort of, you know, you were talking about that culture of violence. And the core message of Check It is, do you have another student's back? Are you willing to be an active participant? In most instances of violence, there's somebody around. It's not, most of the time, if we're talking about rape, for instance, the vast majority of people who are raped know their perpetrator. It's pretty uncommon, not to say that it doesn't happen, but it's pretty uncommon for a stranger to jump out of the woods and
right.
attack somebody.
Right. That happens a lot more in the movies than it does in real life. Not to say it doesn't happen, but you are absolutely right. The vast majority are people that you know. It's a violation of trust.
Yep. And if we prioritize and emphasize our responses to fight stranger attacks, we probably miss most of the good opportunities to do bystander intervention or to change the culture of a place.
So how long has this program been around?
Sure. The Sexual Assault Prevention Committee has been active on campus for more than 15 years. I've been involved for 8 years, and I've been the co-chair for about 6.5 or 7 years. And we teach a one-unit weekend seminar. Paula Arrowsmith-Jones from the North Coast Rape Crisis
Team. We know her well.
And Kim Berry, the chair of Critical Race, Gender, Sexuality Studies, and myself anchor a one-unit prevention class, media challenge class, activist training ground class called the Actions to End Sexualized Violence. And it's been pretty much the sort of one of the highlights of my work here at Humboldt State has been training literally hundreds of students to challenge rape culture and the normalization of violence in our society.
See, that's one of the most exciting parts is dealing with that normalization, that culture of violence that now this has been going for 15 years. How would you gauge its success?
Sure. Well, we're going to do it both anecdotally by saying that we have an increased number of reports, so more people feel comfortable at Humboldt State coming forward with their situation, which I think is a good thing. The idea that sexualized violence is something that should be hidden or obscured is something that works against anybody getting support or accommodation. We also took a really strong survey. We asked and created our own survey instrument to ask HSU students about their experiences of sexualized violence, about the agencies on and off campus they've used to respond. And the survey was gigantic, and we had something along, 1,800 students successfully completed it out of 7,000, which makes our claims from that very pretty solid. And we know there's a lot of harm on campus, and we're hoping to reapply that instrument in, 2.5 years and see if those numbers change. And so anecdotally, I have a number of reasons to think that the culture's changing here, but statistically, in another year or two, we're going to have something else to say about that.
You left some actual hard data there.
Yeah.
Fantastic. So one of the areas that has obviously showed itself in recent times where there is a culture of violence is in the NFL. It is, the Rice incident, and many others, of course, have now come to the forefront. And the NFL is, of course, having to deal with this head on. And kudos for them to actually taking some steps. I mean, there were some missteps in the beginning. There was no doubt about that.
I would say that's true. Yeah.
Yeah, but they seem to be taking it seriously. But here you do have an organized sport where aggression, of course, is built into it, and training that off the field, making sure that doesn't translate into home life, that can be a little difficult.
Sure. I mean, I would also note that the likelihood of living as a roommate with an NFL player is pretty slim.
Right.
And so we generally, stranger attack, I think, to sort of isolate the NFL rather than thinking about sort of the very broad perspective. Perpetrators can be just about anybody. And I mean, one of the things that I think is real interesting about Ray Rice is that prior to the charges and the video surfacing, he had volunteered and provided some public service announcement work for a local domestic violence shelter. And the thing that I think that's really valuable about that is that even good guys abuse and rape. And I think the interesting thing about Ray Rice is not the particularly toxic moment of violence, but the sense that, in essence, we're talking about a very widespread problem. And when we isolate it to sports events or something like that, I think we miss a lot of education opportunities. If we imagine that the NFL trains monsters, it's really hard to educate and talk to monsters, right? But if we imagine that they're normal people who have absorbed particular stories about sexuality, masculinity, violence, and competition, then I think there's the possibility for education and transformation there.
I think the thing that the positive that comes from something like this is, a lot of, NFL players are celebrities, and they're sort of held above.
Mm-hmm.
When someone who is a celebrity who is held above all of a sudden is embroiled in something like this, it kind of is like it calls attention to it, to a broader issue.
Yeah.
So not to say that the NFL in general has a history of training monsters. With that said, there is a culture of aggression built into it.
Sure.
And, and we've got a lot of that in so many different aspects, of our lives. And come to, expect certain things. We have certain built-in expectations that something you're dealing with, here on the campus of Humboldt State University is, sometimes, you've got people who go to a party, for instance, and there's a few drinks had, and there's certain expectations that certain things will happen in some minds, and it can be completely misunderstood, and
Yeah.
Assault happens.
Absolutely. And, you know, the real interesting thing about that sort of anecdote is that, you know, it's such a classic story about university life, is the sort of drunken sexual miscommunication element. And I think it's one of the real strengths of the Sexual Assault Prevention Committee's work, which is that we generally work from the perspective of cultivating healthy sexuality, encouraging conversation, and what we call on the campus enthusiastic consent, which is that you generally want everybody involved in a sex act to be really psyched about it at all times, and that consent can always be withdrawn, you know. And so if you sort of change the approach, the language, the conversation, and, you know, I'm optimistic about the next generation. As a sort of, you know, sort of older person, I really see consciousness and awareness about their own communities that I think even the folks in my generation didn't necessarily perceive. And so I sort of think that there's a real chance to challenge some of the, and I think what you're talking about in the drinking miscommunication part is entitlement, the sense that anybody's entitled to or guaranteed sex. And, you know, that's an argument, an idea that I would love to dissuade people of.
Well, absolutely. And the concepts, and it seems almost ridiculous this has to be mentioned, but it's still true that no means no.
Yep.
I mean, there is. I still hear to this day some people saying, "Well, that's women always say no."
I watched an episode of How I Met Your Mother the other night, mm-hmm. on Netflix, and had this sudden realization that for probably four or five times in this 2014 comedy show, no's were the invitation to a reapplication for sexual consent. And admittedly, it's a fictional story,
but
humorous, but I don't think you have to go very far to find media representations where no's get sort of turned into yes through heavy persuasion. And one of the most toxic stories given to masculinity was that the job was to be the base runner or the pursuer, right? The idea that women are infielders in the base running, you get to second base or third base.
Right, right. That was part of the vernacular growing up.
Yeah, absolutely. And I still ask classes this, and I would say 90% of them are familiar with this metaphor.
Wow.
And, you know, but just generally the idea that you would be entitled to something and the goal would be to trick or persuade or pressure someone into sex. And that old discourse is pretty poisonous when we note that that is now sexual assault, rape, and always had been, but the language is sort of changing now. And I think what's necessary is a certain sympathy for older generations of men who swam in that discourse while still holding them accountable. Even if you're old, you still got to get with the program now. And that means yes and no means no. Enthusiastic consent is what you got to have before you get it on.
So you are seeing in dealing with the students, today's students, that there does seem to be a shift that you were seeing?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Let's just note that the largest sort of student movement active at the moment is the Know Your Nine folks, which is a group of college students using Facebook to simultaneously provide support for survivors and help coach them in filing Title IX federal violations and complaints, that 78 colleges and universities in the United States are being investigated for Title IX violations, is, you know, we are talking about a movement that is, I think, in the legacy of the civil rights movement, which is a sympathetic presidential administration and activists on the ground who are pushing for culture change through law. The Campus Save Act, which is coming out and will be implemented, which is going to change a lot of the ways that colleges and universities have to do this sort of stuff. And
explain what that is.
Sure. Sexual Violence Elimination Act, which was passed last year, and it'll be implemented this coming sort of year. And it will be a requirement that colleges and universities provide accommodations for survivors of sexualized violence, that they provide sort of reasonable timeframes for the judicial cases, and that there be more transparency and engagement, as well as there's a couple other elements of Campus Save. Everybody's going to have to do that campus survey that I was talking about. That's sort of it's a pretty good moment politically to be a part of challenging violence. I mean, if you've been doing this for 19 years, this is some of the most significant traction and conversation we've had. And if you're out there riding the fence, trying to figure out where you sit, it is a really good time to throw your weight behind change and nonviolence.
Well, absolutely. I mean, let's just look just last year during the political season. I mean, there were certain things that were said by mainstream politicians that were jaw-dropping, dealing with, sexual consent and rape and things that were implied, and women's rights, and it was just shocking.
And I think it's one of the great things about being a communication professor is that you get the ability to look at those moments and describe the sort of power forces at work. I mean, I really, and to a certain degree, I appreciate sexist politicians who make their intentions more evident because they become fruitful teaching moments. I don't think they're any less toxic, but there's something amazing about folks who speak it out loud, and then there's the chance for contestation and debate about it.
Absolutely. I mean, that was the term legitimate rape. It was one of those things that just everyone was just like, what? Yeah. What did I just hear? And dialogue came out of it.
But let's note that that's not that far away from a concept like date rape, right? Which is a term that many advocates have used for many years. And it doesn't really matter whether you're parking your car, flying an airplane, or having a burger. That's rape. Like, you to identify that it changes status for some reason or becomes not legitimate because you were on a date or something is exactly, I think, the same thing as real or legitimate rape. And we're generally talking about victim blaming, which is the sense that survivors of sexualized violence did something. And one of the things I'll make real clear is that perpetrators make that decision. We hold the accountability with those who choose to commit violence, and we provide support and care for those who experience it and attempt to prevent it from going down.
Well, it's less institutionalized today, but it is still an argument that you will see in court where victims are blamed.
Absolutely.
And it's frightening.
Yeah. And I think that may be part of the reason why we have such low rates of conviction for perpetration, which is it's very difficult to enter into the legal system to make a charge of rape or intimate partner violence.
But one thing that you mentioned, and that's absolutely worth reiterating, is differentiating the different types of rape, date rape and this kind of rape and that kind of rape. Rape is rape.
Yeah.
This is unconsensual sex.
Yep.
And the reality is, when it is that, it's a power grab. It is not it's not an act of love. It is not really an act of sex. It's an act of violence.
Mm-hmm. And I think, the core of it is that sense of accountability. And what I think both of us are pointing at is the sense that we long for folks to both own their sexuality and also to strive for inclusion of yes, which is, I'm into this. Let's go. And that's where you would hope that things would be.
Right. Now, I grew up in the 60s, and this was, the time of sexual freedom and, make love, not war. And while that was liberating, there was still a lot of backwards thinking with regard to sex and sexual consent. Yeah. And all of that. And we are finally, the dialogue is finally starting to really be fully accepted. Yeah. There have always been people who have said this kind of thing.
Yeah.
But it's always been, yeah. Right.
Yeah.
Right. Nudge, nudge, wink, wink.
My definition of communication, the field that I study, is how ideas change over time. And we map the representations of ideas about rape in the 60s and in the 70s, and you can see the changes in newspaper conversations, in politician dialogue. And I think that we really are seeing a transformation of the popular consciousness. And I think there are some lagging elements. Stalking is one of those things that we don't have great language for. I think dating violence and intimate partner violence is not necessarily, I think that there's still a lot of victim blaming and bogus justifications for dating violence, and especially among folks who don't like date, who imagine themselves just as lovers or partners or buddies who have sex sometimes, the idea that violence between those two doesn't count as intimate partner violence. And I think that misunderstanding is still going to take us a couple years to get at.
The good news is, though, is that attitudes do change.
Yeah.
There is a slow progression of learning and a changing of attitudes. Sometimes attitudes will shift over a very glacial amount of time. Sometimes it happens rather quickly, such as the general attitude in this country with same-sex marriage. In the course of really just a few years, there was quite a seismic shift in the attitudes in this country. And I think there will be an interesting amount of, I'll be curious to see some studies as to how that happened. I mean, that was one of those things that I think sociologists will be looking at for a while.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. But this is, you know, the things we're talking about today, there is some traction that is taking place. As you mentioned, you know, this is the time to be on the side of speaking
consent,
out and consent,
nonviolence, inclusion, compassion, the sense that, you know, we should support those around us who might be survivors, that we would work really hard to hold those that we care about accountable, that we would call out bogus rape jokes, that we'd end those conversations about the Niners raping somebody else or the tax man coming to, you know, that the casual language and the genuine sort of like apology stuff, that's work that every aunt or uncle or cousin can do at Thanksgiving dinner, which is just busting up those old stories. And you out there in the radio land here in the 707 are highly qualified to do so. And we ask you to get involved.
And with that said, you know, one of the things that you are teaching is not to be a bystander.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of things take place in full view of other people. And when you speak out and say, wait a minute, that's not okay.
Yeah.
You know, you're doing your part. When you see something happen and you just go, well, it's just the way it is, you're contributing.
Let me challenge that just a little bit, Cliff.
Okay.
What if we thought of that as preparation time for the next time they got to get their game together? And I'm sympathetic to the sense that something might go down in the post office that you are not prepared or able to debate. And so if that happens and you feel guilty afterward, just get ready for the next throwdown. You know that some idiot is going to say that stuff. You may as well be ready to debate them the next time. I think guilt in this situation is really not super productive. And I don't want people to ride the fence, but I also want that honest sense that, you know, everybody flubs some educational moments. Everybody realizes 20 minutes later that they should have said something wonderfully insightful.
Well, it's one thing to say something to a stranger, but too often our friends, you know, our colleagues, people we know and sometimes love will say things that you know are not right.
Yeah.
And a lot of times we just keep quiet about it. If you were to just say, you know, that's not cool.
Yeah.
That right there is like, whoa.
Yep. And sometimes you pull them aside later in private so that they don't get too embarrassed.
Sure.
But strategically, you can say that's not cool, I think. And I would say that if somebody around you thinks you're cool, like if you have voice or standing in them, if they're in your family, if they're a friend of yours, if you've ever loaned the money, like you get standing with them. And that's the kind of place where I think we should definitely be using our voices.
Yeah. I mean, I've seen in my lifetime, ethnic jokes ran rampant. I mean, everyone told ethnic jokes.
Yeah.
No one does anymore. You do that, you get this look like,
what are you
what
doing?
What planet are you from? It's like, whoa.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it changes attitude.
Let me throw in three quick tools. We say distract, delegate, or direct when we talk about bystander intervention. And so we might think about a wide variety of strategies for folks in moments of potential harm where you might be able to do something. But again, the goal is not confrontation or some big showdown to show that you're smarter or better. The goal is to actually reduce the likelihood of violence.
Right.
So reflect, think, challenge those who have you have standing with, and be a good community member. And I don't think that's that hard to ask of folks.
Maxwell, we are just about out of time, so I want to give you the last few moments here to make sure you say anything that that we didn't talk about.
Sure. You know, I'll just give a quick shout out to some of our best partners, the campus organization Check It, which provides training for student organizations and leadership, as well as support for off-campus bystander interventions, the North Coast Rape Crisis Team, who are phenomenal allies for the campus. The HSU administration have been exceptionally supportive for our work most of the time, and of course, counseling and psychological services, housing, the dean's office, the dean of students, all have provided tangible and real support. And all those folks, that's not necessarily their job. And what they said was, this is important, and when it goes down, we've got your back. And I really want to thank all the folks, no matter where they're at, including you, who have occasionally said, you know, hey, I've got your back. And that means a lot in a community as small as this. I think we've got the opportunity to transform this place we live and to make a real difference in the lives of the people around us. And I think this radio program and what it embodies is a big part of that. So thank you very much.
All righty. Professor Maxwell Scherner, thank you so much.
You're welcome, Cliff.